oftentimes it's better to start with creativity to help you learn the facts.
Life is too short to learn a list of 1,000 rando words.
From the campus of Stanford University, this is Schools In with your hosts, Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope.
Welcome to Schools In. I'm Denise Pope, senior lecturer with the Graduate School of Education at Stanford, and I am with my co-host, Dan Schwartz, who is dean of the Graduate School of Education. I should say that we are not recording from the studio today due to COVID-19 restrictions. We are recording remotely, and our guest will be remote as well.
But I have a very FM sounding mic at
you,
home.
You so, do, Dan.
Thank you. So Denise, R01 Pope.
R01.
Yeah. Do you know what that refers to?
That's the COVID, right?
No.
That is what R01 is, right? That's my brain.
It's a Research One University, which means you're eligible for certain classes of funding, say from the National Institute for Health.
Got it.
Right. And so the major universities are all R01. Your liberal art college probably is not.
Okay.
Because
right?
they don't have the equipment and things like that. And the reason I'm bringing that up is because we're going to be talking about sort of the rise and purpose of universities today. And so I've got a challenge for you.
Okay.
A hard challenge.
Okay.
So as you know, there's increasing distrust and disfavor of universities. Do you know about this?
Yes. Oh, we are liberal bastions. We are socialists. We are not good for young people on our campuses. Yes. A lot of people don't like us right now.
And we're elite.
Elite.
It's hard to get in.
Yeah. Expensive.
And so everybody wants to come, but they can't. And so we're elite.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a big concern for universities that do, you know, tremendous public good. To be in disfavor, you know, in the sights of Congress, for example. So there was an interesting study that examined what language, phrases, attributes made people excited about universities. So they would say, what do you think about Yale? Right. And then they'd say, well, what do you think about an institution that does X? And people would really rate the does X very high.
Mm.
Right. As opposed to Yale. And of course, the does X things were things that universities do.
Including Yale.
Including Yale.
Yes. Yes. But
Stanford even more, of course.
Of course.
But what were the two things that rose to the top that in this sort of advertising survey were the things that were the most compelling to people and brought the most favor?
That is a good question. Okay, I'm going to take one. I mean, these are wild guesses. Maybe do good for the community around them. Would that be something that would, I don't know. Make sure everyone gets jobs afterwards.
Good try.
I don't know. To teach people to think critically. Some people don't like that. Clearly, some politicians don't want us to think critically. We are sheep. They want sheep.
So we should do something about politicians where we say, do you like politicians? Do you like people who develop infrastructure for society?
Right.
So
exactly.
So the two were research innovations.
Ah.
And the second, the second
research,
one was
research innovations.
Yeah.
Okay.
Innovations, research innovations.
Okay.
The second one was transforming lives.
Oh. So is that why you took it to be the GSC motto?
So if you listen to how I talk about the Graduate School of Education,
oh my god,
it's not about how hard it is to get admitted or how posh the campus is. It's about research, innovation, and transforming lives.
Okay, so I thought that you really believed in transforming lives.
I do.
You're just doing it because of that one study.
No. That's way too cynical. That's
even
way too
for
cynical.
You.
But
even
but you
for
know
you.
If I do a slide presentation, I show people and research. I don't show the campus.
Interesting. Yeah.
Right.
No, that's
right.
Good. Because
you really want to highlight what is absolutely unique about a university, and it's. We're amazing at transforming people's lives and at doing research innovations that no other institution can do.
I love that.
Yeah, yeah. But it was interesting. You know, the exact attributes that make these R01s great, if you name them, people really like universities. But if you say the name of the university that they and their buddies didn't get into. It's just like, you lose.
Boo. Yeah. Interesting. Well, I'm excited to meet our guest.
Yes. So we're lucky. We have Emily Levine, who is the world's leading scholar on the rise of American universities. And she's also a professor of education at Stanford. And she looks at how the history of higher education and its role in society. And she has a new book coming out. So that's why a very important and busy person agreed to talk to us. And it's called Allies and Rivals, German-American Exchange and the Rise of the Modern Research University. And so in it, she tries to explain how innovators in Europe and US sort of both competed and collaborated to give the rise of the American research university. So welcome, Emily.
Thank you so much for having me. I did not get that question right. I was guessing science and teaching. So
research innovations, science and engineering.
Science and engineering, because
the engineering's your cell phone, right? And people like that, they like their cell phone.
So you would have got it right, Emily. I got it wrong. There you go. You're still an expert.
Critical thinking. What are you thinking, Denise?
Yeah.
Critical thinking. Oh my God.
I'm thinking what I wish people had more of. That's what I'm thinking.
That's right. Yeah. So before we get going, a little backdrop on what was the state of colleges and universities before the modern era? Like, was there a unified purpose of colleges around the world, universities? Or was it just sort of an evolution and they just kind of showed up and different ones did different things?
Right, like a Big Bang Theory. It's a great question. And I think it gets at sort of your initial story, Dan, because there's just so many myths to dispel and misconceptions about, I think, universities and the history of higher education. For one, I think we actually take for granted that science and other higher advanced forms of learning are housed in universities, but there's no necessary connection between the two. And actually, historically, as you allude to, this hasn't always been the case. So if we go back to the 19th century, if you're talking about Europe, in Paris and London, it was academies that were the places where science is done. The academies gave prizes and published journals and advised the government.
So an academy is like the club. So I belong to the American Psychological Association. That's an academy.
Yeah, or the Academy of the Paris Academy of Science, or these are places that where scientists gathered to do their experiments. That ultimately these institutions published transactions that would publish journalistic findings, but they weren't teaching in the way that universities would come to teach. Insofar as teaching existed, this happened in colleges. But as you pointed out, colleges were largely religious institutions. They were sectarian institutions. So on the eve of the American Revolution, there were 9 homegrown college institutions, all variations on the English and Scottish theme. At best, probably the most charitable reading of them was that they were preparations for a learned clergy. And at worst, they were sort of finishing schools for young boys, right? Built by the money that we got from the Atlantic slave trade, right? These were not places that inspired awe and science and innovation, as you described. But this begins to change over the course of the Enlightenment, in particular in Europe, when state builders began to see colleges and universities as a place where they could teach individuals, transform, if not lives, teach them to become better civil servants, right? Better tax collectors, better administrators of their states. And so they were willing to encourage more freedom, more innovative ways to teach religion in order to get those state building effects. And this basically comes to a head at the beginning of the 19th century, following the defeat of Napoleon. The King of Prussia decides we better not lose any more wars. And if we're not going to lose any more wars, we better create an institution that makes us better soldiers, that makes us better state leaders, and perhaps helps to cultivate a sense of what it means to be German. And so he calls on a on a scholar by the name of Wilhelm von Humboldt to design a new education system from child to a university student. And what he creates, among other things, is an institution that merges the project of the advancement of knowledge, which is what we think of as research, with the dissemination of knowledge, which is what we might call teaching. And so those two activities, research and teaching, come together in what becomes the German Research University. And that is what becomes the envy of the world.
This is Schools In with Denise Pope and Dan Schwartz. We are talking with Emily Levine about the rise of the research university. And interesting that it was, you know, sort of a military spurred creation, right? We don't want to keep losing wars. Because I think of military colleges, right? That's what came to mind there. But you're talking about a little bit more than that.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think that that's another sort of surprising element when we think about what are the motivations, both internal and external, that spur change. Oftentimes it would be wars, or we can talk, as I'm sure we will, about our current state, the pandemic, and what that external shock to our system may do to our own institutions. But, you know, historians like to tease apart these different motivations for change. And I would think that it's not just wars, but also internal competition, what I call in the book competitive emulation, or the cooperation and competition that existed that spurred different institutional innovations. And then, of course, leaders, individuals. I mean, that's why I'm a historian, because I think that lives really matter here. And it's the creative and successful academic innovators and entrepreneurs who made these institutions what they became.
So do you think when von Humboldt put the two sides of the coconut together, mm-hmm. and showed it to other people, did they go, no. Oh my goodness, that's so brilliant? Or were they like, are you insane? We could never do that.
You mean two sides of the coconut, meaning research and teaching.
Yeah.
Together.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, it's amazing, really, because, as I said, there's no self-evident reason why you would put these together. And it was never predetermined, but it was a clear trade-off, I think. We give you autonomy, you scholars, certain unprecedented amount of autonomy to do your innovation. Maybe you'll come up with a cell phone. Maybe you'll discover the cell in biology, right? I mean, maybe something amazing will happen, but we'll give you that autonomy in exchange from your providing key services to our society, namely training our students so that they can go on to become tax collectors, so that they become soldiers, so that they become clergy. And that brilliant insight, that hybrid, that is was itself a hybrid institution, is exactly what foreigners came to see. And they came in droves. Over the course of the 19th century, nearly 10,000 Americans came to study in Berlin, in Göttingen, in Halle, to experience that coconut, as you described it. And they came from Japan. They came from Great Britain. Matthew Arnold thought that these institutions put the British ones to shame. And soon the founding fathers, Jefferson, Adams, Madison, and those who came after, begin to pine for a university in the German model. We need one of those in the new America. Now, the traditional narrative is that the Americans then steal this, right? They import the German university to America. But in my book, I show the archives reveal a much more complicated story. Because these American returnees, they convert their experiences studying abroad into educational reform and leadership at home. They go on to become the U.S. American university presidents. And consider this fact. 45 U.S. university presidents were alumni of the University of Göttingen and the University of Leipzig alone. And they don't just cut and paste the German graduate school. They create a new hybrid institution of their own. And their hybrid version will combine that earlier English model, right, the Yales and Harvards and William and Marys of the 17th century, with its BA that it is granting in the traditional study of the liberal arts, with this new German PhD and the devotion to pure research, to make a new two-sided coconut that we call now the modern research university that we are sitting in today at Stanford, and of course would be emulated the world over.
This is Schools In with Denise Pope and Dan Schwartz. We are speaking with Emily Levine about how we got to the Stanfords of the United States. And her book on this is called Allies and Rivals. So who are the allies and who are the rivals?
I guess it's a bit of a trick there, right? The allies and rivals, on the one hand, they're clearly the Germans and the Americans, right? Who are emerging as the new world powers in the late 19th century. They're the latecomer empires that are trying to build their empires and taking on new ideas of themselves as world leaders. But they're, and in that respect, they are rivals for that new title, but they're also allies in the new social sciences, and they are partners, you could say, in institutional innovation, right? And it's that kind of competitive, cooperative relationship in which they are both working together in a sort of cosmopolitan or global aim, according to the values of science, to found, you know, various, to innovate in various fields. But they're also competing to get there first, right? And to have the best institutions that have the most visitors, that give the most prestige, that make the most publications, that ultimately have the most Nobel Prizes, and the most sort of ephemeral and kind of nebulous thing, that have the highest amount of status.
And then even within the U.S., there's competition, and there's still competition today. I mean, you heard Dan say, well, we're better than Yale, right? So, right. And is that because they're fighting over federal money? Is that because, you know, what causes that?
Yeah, well, that's kind of what makes it a little bit tricky, is that you can't just reduce these institutions to their national context or to their community. You have both this intramural competition, as you're saying, and you have this international kind of competition. And, you know, one way to look at this actually is that, you know, in the early phase when Americans were still sort of pupils to the German teacher, if you will, they were competing with Germany to make the best versions of the German institutions. And the first of these would be Johns Hopkins, founded in 1876 in Baltimore. But it was so successful in the way that it created this hybrid. And here by it, I mean its founding president, Daniel Coit Gilman, the way he merged both the American style BA and the focus on undergraduates with the German style PhD and the focus on research, that it became almost a victim of its success. So within two decades, there were copycats like Stanford and Chicago who were doing this almost better than Hopkins. And so if you look from the domestic standpoint, you start to see, well, Hopkins is already kind of being swallowed up by its competition. But if you look from the international standpoint, by 1900, America has now produced this very robust system with a diverse set of institutions that are giving Germany a run for its money.
Totally fascinating. This is Schools In with Denise Pope and Dan Schwartz, and we will have more with Emily Levine talking about the rise of the research university in the U.S. and actually in the globe next on Sirius XM.
You're listening to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope.
So it is hard to predict what the future will be.
The focus is really on academics.
From the campus of Stanford University.
Welcome back to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We are talking with Emily Levine, who wrote a book about really the rise of the U.S. research university called Allies and Rivals.
So these research universities are really big, complex enterprises. And David Labrie, the historian, was talking about sort of every small town wanted a college because it brought them reputation. And so there, you know, you have the mayor of the town and a couple of people. They say, let's build a college. How do you get all these different stakeholders and sectors of the economy, the politicians on page to like make a giant university or even a small one?
Yeah, that's a great question, Dan. And I think that history offers a number of really important lessons about what we might call that entrepreneurial academic leadership. So if we look more closely at what whom I would call the original founding president of the Johns Hopkins University. It was the first modern research university in America, founded in 1876. And we look at the founding president, Daniel Coyd Gilman. He's a great exemplar of many of those features that are required for someone to be successful in that endeavor, that negotiating that complex terrain that you just laid out. So Gilman is someone who's born in 1831 to descendant of founders of Norwich, Connecticut. He begins his career in New England, which is really important in the 19th century. He has those New England bona fides. He spends the early part of his career cataloging the library of George Washington, and then has the chance in 1854 to travel to Europe to visit what he says are the three typical institutions of his day: the English residential college, the technical school, and the research university. And so he's really poised to determine what the post-Civil War American institution is going to look at. And so he tries, and he has three tries, and I would say it takes three tries to get it right. The first time he tries to line up all the different partners is at Yale in the 1850s. And he tries to turn Yale into a modern research university by raising the admission standards, by expanding the scientific part of the school. He fundraises. He gets the largest benefaction to date of about $100,000 to found the Sheffield Science School. And he gets the old guard, these classical and religious scholars, to begin to give the PhD, which is the first American institution to do this in 1861. But he comes up against this old guard that wants to keep Greek and Latin and religious instruction is really the heart of the university. And so he leaves and he goes to the University of California, second try to try to get it right. An institution that's become a new land grant institution, which means that it's now been given money from the sale of lands after the Morrill Act is passed in 1862 in exchange for agreeing to become an institution devoted to the agricultural and industrial sciences. And he thinks this is my opportunity to create America's premier modern research university. But he realizes that in a state institution, you have to fight with the Board of Regents, and he has the agricultural lobby, and they think that Gilman is elitist, and they basically run him out of town. The third time is a charm for him. And in 1874, he's invited to become the founding president of the Johns Hopkins University. It's a new university. Crucially, it's going to be the first privately funded university in America with an endowment of $3.5 million. So this is much bigger than the last benefaction of $100,000. So here we have a story of America, right? The money's getting bigger and bigger. But crucially, they say that you're going to have no strings attached, right? It's going to be non-denominational, non-sectarian, none of those nasty religious fights from earlier in the 18th and 19th century, just you and the leaders of the institution will determine what's right. Well, so does that mean he has no contracting partner, Dan? Who do you think his contracting partner is now? It's not the state, and it's not the corporation and its religious fellows. It's the moneyed and learning men of Baltimore, right?
Right.
It's the donors.
The donors. Exactly, Denise. So that's the new contracting partner.
Right? Hey. I never got a chance to answer.
Okay, sorry. I jumped in. But you understand.
Education professor, I don't do wait time. Yeah.
But Dan, you of all people understand the need to please the donors.
The need to help them see what are good investments.
Indeed. And that's exactly what Gilman would do, right? He basically goes to his trustee. One of them's a jurist and an amateur scientist. One of them's a former mayor who believes in the centrality of research. And initially he says, let's do away with these undergraduates. He says, you know, they're a nuisance. They're not what's really important. What he really wants is just a German style institution devoted to science and research. But the philanthropists don't see how this would help their emerging industrial city. They need somewhere to send their boys to be minted in the sciences, to have a fancy degree. And so he basically realizes, in order to get his new contracting partners, the philanthropists, on board, he has to give them something in exchange. And thus comes the hybrid that he creates, which is by smushing together the BA degree of the liberal arts with the PhD of the German institution, he gets this new institution. And it's the result of the negotiation between the different constituents. And it's a winning combination.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We're talking with Emily Levine about a winning combination for starting a really effective U.S. research university. are there lessons from this guy that we can apply today? Because as we started off this show, we're sort of in a mess here. What do you think?
Yeah, well, first of all, I think there's the lesson of leadership, right? Which is that what we see among the entrepreneurs, the academic entrepreneurs from Wilhelm von Humboldt all the way to Clark Kerr, right, who was the 12th president of the University of California, who was famous for writing himself out of the script, right, and making it seem as if he were sort of invisible. These institutions were just sort of inventing themselves. And what we see among these figures is that they're very skilled at moving back and forth between different circles, but moving between the scholars and their values of science and pure research and the needs of society, be they economic or political. And you often don't know what side they're really on, which I think is also really key, right? Did Gilman promote application to win the donors, but in fact believe in pure research in his heart? Or was he really captured by industry and using the language of pure inquiry to appease the faculty? And, you know, I think that that chameleon-like quality of that the negotiation required to move across this complex terrain is really what we need in our leaders today.
One of the things about Stanford that I've heard was an important move is that maybe in the 50s, it began partnering with industry. Mm-hmm. And, you know, engineering was the pathway. Was that a novel thing that industry suddenly became one of the partners in the social contract for universities?
Yeah, well, I think that what's important to realize is that over time, the social contract embodied different combinations, right? And so industrialists were already involved in the 1870s. And so far as the, you know, it's Johns Hopkins, who is the head of the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad, who gives the money for Johns Hopkins. And those, you know, it's many railroad men, of course, railroad men also who found Stanford as well. So industry is involved, you could say, from the beginning, albeit that industry perhaps changes over time. So, you know, what's unique about Stanford in the late 50s and early 60s, when Fred Terman goes after new government grants and new industrial revolution relations, is just new partners get added to the mix, right? And of course, in that period of Cold War science in which he was reacting, the money is even greater than the $3.5 million that Johns Hopkins gives for the founding of the university. We see even more students who, of course, because of the GI Bill, ultimately will be able to make use of these institutions.
Emily, that was awesome. Thank you so much for being here. Thank all of you for listening to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. If you missed any of this episode, listen anytime on demand with the SiriusXM app and anywhere you listen to podcasts.
From the campus of Stanford University, this has been Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope on SiriusXM Business Radio. If you missed any of it, listen on demand, online, or with the SiriusXM app.